So you might be able to tell by the fact that this show is called the Race Car Podcast and not the Race Car Driver Podcast that my main area of interest in motorsports is ultimately the machines. You know, the people who built them and the people who drove them, sure, but ultimately I want to talk about the metal more than I want to talk about any of the other aspects of it. I think that's why I don't have a ton of time for spec series. It's certainly why I struggle with IndyCar. The racing's fabulous, it's much more entertaining than Formula One, but the cars all look exactly the same. Even if we went back to when Honda and Chevy had their own aero kits, I'd probably feel a little bit better, but it's difficult for me to get extremely excited to watch 30 of the same car compete for the win, as high quality as that racing may be. F1, I suppose, is kind of similar, and that Red Bull clearly has a better concept than anybody else, so you see the green Red Bull and the white Red Bull, and whatever color Visa Cash App RB Red Bull we get this season. Sure, there's different engine manufacturers, but the rule set's so narrow that it's a minor miracle when somebody is able to successfully pull off something outside of the norm, like Mercedes splitting their turbo at the start of the turbo hybrid era. That's why I love sports car racing, even though, yeah, some of the parity is maybe artificial due to BOP, but I like seeing Corvettes running with Mustangs and 911s and Ferraris and Lexus and Aston Martins, and they're all within 3/4 of a second at their best. And even the LMDH, the hypercars, GTPs, you know, and you got somebody like Peugeot doing weird stuff and being about as quick as Porsche or Toyota, and I think that's great. We used to have more of that, but the need to bring down costs has narrowed all the rule books, which I get it. And when WEC IMSA has a golden age like they do right now, it's all the more impressive, and I'm all the more thankful to see it. It wasn't always that way, though. Not all that long ago, you could more or less do whatever hadn't been done before, because the rule books were written in such a way where they told you what you couldn't do, instead of now where they tell you what you can do. That's how we got the Chaparral 2J sucker cars, and how we got Brabham BT52 pit stop cars, and even the R32 GTR of my last episode. And if the 70s, 80s, and 90s were not times with the rigid rules, then the 60s absolutely weren't. Like, think about Smokey Unix Indy 500 capsule car, as trash as it may have been, or the Shelby Cobra, or the Lotus 49B with its big dumb wing. If you could dream it, you could race it somewhere, including the greatest spectacle in motorsports, the Indy 500. How nuts could you get? I mean, turbine helicopter engine nuts, apparently. Hello, and welcome back to the Race Car Podcast. So, I actually started writing this episode the day I released the R32 pod, which, as I sit here recording it now, was exactly 1 week ago. So I'm going to try to stick with that, so we'll see how it goes. And I enjoyed that show, you know, because winners are always easy to research and talk about. There's usually a lot of information on them. So let's get back to normalcy and weird stuff and talk about turbine-powered open-wheel race cars. Specifically, the STP Paxton Turbo Car, the Shelby Turbine, and the Lotus 56. So, fun fact, before I started looking into this, the 56 was the only one of those three vehicles that I really knew anything about, and what I thought I knew about it was wrong, but that's really kind of a skill issue on my part, I suppose. I initially was just going to talk about the 56, but it became apparent pretty quickly that I really couldn't without talking about the other two. That's fine, though, because it's not like the R32s or 917s with tons of history, so we'll just make one episode out of the three of them and we'll see how it goes. Interestingly, none of these cars is the first turbine car at Indy. In 1955, a Curtis Craft chassis was fitted with a turbine engine and used for testing and promotion for Strategic Air Command to show the kind of neat jobs that you could do there. The car did not, however, attempt to actually participate in the race. In 1962, though, John Zink brought his turbine-powered track burner to try and qualify for the race. It was handed first to a young Dan Gurney, who had just passed his rookie test, and he ran 143 miles per hour with the car in qualifying, which was not fast enough to make the race, and sure not fast enough to stop Gurney from driving for Mickey Thompson in the race instead. Dwayne Carter would also try but fail to qualify the car. Turbine stuff at this point would go quiet for a few years until 1967, and a car called Silent Sam or the Whooshmobile, but officially called the STP Paxton Turbo Car. So STP, and that's Scientifically Treated Petroleum, by the way, was founded in 1953, was acquired by Studebaker in 1961, and shortly thereafter they hired Andy Granatelli as their CEO. Granatelli was, along with his brothers Vince and Joe, a longtime racer. They'd been to the Indy 500 several times, starting in 1946. Apparently, they were the first to ever show up there with fully independent suspension, which I think is pretty cool. So, Granatelli became the public face of STP and got the company heavily involved in motorsports. in 1961. In fact, he bought the rights to the Novi V8, originally built by Offenhauser in the 1940s, and brought it back to Indy. Supercharged this time, the Novi made an absolute ton of noise and power, the final version of it making 837 horsepower from only 2.7 liters, which is kind of crazy from a 1940s engine. So it is funny to me how much in racing, how much it's like the more things change, the more they stay the same sort of thing. Because right here, the story mirrors my last episode. 30 years earlier and half a world away from the R32 Skyline GTR, when faced with the problem of not being able to put down a ridiculous amount of horsepower, Granatelli and STP employed the Ferguson four-wheel drive system. So Granatelli's cars ran the Novi for a few years from 63 to 66, with the four-wheel drive car coming on in 65. They never really amounted to all that much, but they were fan favorites because the cars sounded awesome. Granatelli, though, was not satisfied with that, so in 1967, things would change. Like, a lot. So, Ken Wallace, he was a British fella who had an idea for a turbine-powered Indy racer, and he took that idea directly to Andy Granatelli. No, that's not true. Andy and STP were actually Ken's third stop, after a pair of notable names. Dan Gurney, at this point no longer an Indy rookie and a winner of several Formula One races, was the first man Wallace approached. Gurney passed, concentrating on his own Eagle Racing chassis for Formula One in 1967. As an aside, Gurney would become the last driver to win a Formula One race in a car of his own design when he won Spa in 1967. Next stop, Carroll Shelby. Wallace explained the benefits, Shelby declared them hogwash, and sent Wallace on his way. Okay, good, fine, I didn't want you guys anyway, I wanted STP all along, was probably what Wallace thought as he arrived at the almost certainly day-glow-colored offices of Andy Granatelli. Above everything except for racing, Granatelli was a showman. Commercials where he arm-wrestled Rocky Marciano, tens of millions of STP stickers appearing on tens of millions of cars in America. Andy Granatelli acted like he was here for a good time, not a long time. I would imagine he was a guy who would certainly see the value in something as off the wall as a turbine-powered race car, so sure enough, he took Wallace up on his offer. Wallace was set up in Joe Granatelli's Paxton Supercharger shop, and he started work on the car. It would have an aluminum space frame, and Andy Granatelli came up with perhaps its two most prominent features aside from the turbine itself. Firstly, the car would utilize the Ferguson four-wheel drive system, like Granatelli's last Novi racers, and secondly, the driver would sit not behind the engine, like in a Roadster, or ahead of it, like the current hot open-wheel setup, but rather aside the engine, with the engine on the left side and the driver on the right. The Ferguson all-wheel drive system came all the way from tractors to Formula One, where it won what is, to this day, and I suppose always will be, the only race ever won by a four-wheel drive car in a Formula One rules race, and that car was the Ferguson P99. Sir Stirling Moss drove the car in the 1961 International Gold Cup. This is not a round of the Formula One Championship, but most of the usual suspects were in attendance with period Formula One hardware. It's also the last Formula One win for a front-engine race car, and to its eternal credit, Moss said the P99 was the best Formula One car he ever drove. With the power made by the turbine, a Pratt & Whitney PT6B turbo shaft, the four-wheel drive system seemed like a no-brainer for Indy. With a USAC-designated 24-inch annulus, that's the air intake for the turbine, by the way, the car would make, and remember that because the word annulus is going to be said a bunch in this podcast, So anyway, 24-inch annulus, which is the air intake for the turbine, the car would make 550 or so horsepower. Its top challenger, Ford's dual overhead cam Indy engine, would make about 100 horsepower less. Also, an interesting thing about the turbine engine, it idled at 57% of its full throttle speed, so you only had to let off the brake to get the car moving pretty good. So Granatelli, the showman that he was, decided he needed a big name to drive the car, so he approached Parnelli Jones, winner of the 63 Indy 500, and owner of an all-time great race car driver name. Jones initially didn't want to do it, but Andy was a persuasive guy, and $100,000 in a briefcase and a promise of half the winnings was also persuasive, so Parnelli Jones would drive the STP Paxton turbo car. This, I suppose, is where we get to the most well-known part of the story. Jones would qualify the car sixth at around 166 miles per hour, apparently used to the car's 3-second throttle lag by now, but he would pass four cars in turn one and take the lead from Mario Andretti before turn three. The turbine-powered car would dominate the rain-divided race, leading 171 laps in total, and they were ahead of second place by nearly a full lap. And then it all went wrong. So a transmission bearing failed, which is famously acknowledged as being a $6 part in a very expensive race car, and the car coasted to a halt with only four laps to go. As much as I suppose this could be considered an act of God, driver Parnelli Jones blamed himself for the failure. Quote, "I was never a very smart race driver." He said, "Really, I wasn't an Alonso or some of the others, Rick Mears, for example, that were premium race car drivers. I knew how to go fast, I just didn't know how to go long enough. I was smart, but I wasn't smart enough to realize how good this car was and how much of a lead I had and everything else. I just did stupid things. I accelerated too hard going out of the pits. It was like a dragster because it had all that torque. That certainly hurt it. I just kicked myself in the rear when I stopped to think about how I blew that race away by my driving style." So it ended up being a heart-wrenching loss, but the promise of the Turbine was shown. So Granatelli would return to Indy with another Turbine car the next year, but he would not be the only one. See, Granatelli and Ken Wallace parted ways after 1967, with STP throwing their lot in with Lotus. More on that in a few minutes. Wallace, though, would find work with a gentleman who told him that the Turbine car was hogwash on Carroll Shelby. With sponsorship on board from Goodyear and Botany 500, which I had to look it up, apparently it's a menswear company, I don't know. And with turbine engines from General Electric that would be good for 1,300 horsepower, Wallace built cars for Shelby's drivers Bruce McLaren and Denny Holm. Like the turbo car from 67, the Shelby Turbine also used a four-wheel drive system, though this one was hydrostatic, more like a modern lawn tractor rather than the more traditional Ferguson gear and differential system. Everything looked on pace for Shelby. He even told reporters, quote, "They are the nearest to certain winners ever built in the history of the race," end quote. That may have been kind of true, but then USAC made an unprecedented change to the rules. So USAC, the United States Auto Club there, the sanctioning body for the Indy 500, had a rule which basically said that anything they called legal would remain legal for at least 2 years. And I appreciate that, because you don't want to be changing rules all the time to react to every single little thing. But in the case of turbine engines, they decided they needed to react all the time to every single little thing. So they needed to break their own rule. Urged on largely by Ford, who they asked for advice on how to proceed, which is kind of crazy, isn't it? It's sort of like, okay, hey, Red Bull is running away with the F1 Constructors' Championship. We need to slow them down. Hey, let's ask Mercedes and Ferrari how they think we should rein them in. Makes zero sense to me. Anyway, so urged on by Ford, they cut the size of the Analyst from 24 inches all the way down to 16 inches, decreasing the turbine air intake size by a full 33%. This is a major blow to the Shelby cars, as they were a bit on the portly side, coming in at about 1,800 pounds race ready, so they really did need all that horsepower. Understanding how large of an issue this is, Ken Wallace immediately decided to cheat, and I personally think that's beautiful. You know, there's no time to try to figure out anything legal. Let's not mess around with that. Let's just get right to doing the stuff that kind of dances around the language and the rules, and we'll try to get around that pesky 16-inch Analyst entirely. So what Wallace came up with was a secret compartment behind a sliding panel that, when opened, would give the car full power. Fine, but pretty obvious, thought another man working on a similar project at the time, Craig Breedlove. You might know that name. You probably should if you're listening to the show. Because Breedlove, by 1967, had already held the world land speed record multiple times with a few different vehicles that he had built. So a turbine-powered Indy car was right up his alley. He had actually sourced two of the same GE T58s as Shelby did for his cars, planning to build two of the cars, one for himself and one for the Flying Hawaiian Danny Yongais. He had an agreement with Fansteel, who was a company who manufactures turbine blades, to fund the cars as well as to use their facilities to build them. Anyway, Breedlove's way of getting around the 16-inch Analyst restriction, he said, was a hydraulic cylinder hidden inside the starter motor, and when the car reached 80% power, it would extend and push the air inlet restrictor forward, allowing the engine full power. Breedlove said, quote, "They would never find it in a million years." Incidentally, Breedlove would try to make a deal with Goodyear as well to build his turbine cars for 68, but that never came to fruition after Goodyear gave a ton of sponsorship money to Shelby. However, keep Craig Breedlove kind of like in the back of your head, though, because we'll get back to him in a couple of minutes. So now Shelby's cars make full power, so problem fixed, right? Nope, not even a little bit. The cars were apparently deeply unpleasant to drive, with McLaren only able to lap the car at 158 miles an hour against 170 mile an hour pole speed. He said, quote, "It's a bit of a cross between a Sherman tank and a Formula Ford. It's like trying to write with a rubber pen." And that's one of those things that's like, you've never done it, but you know exactly what he means, and even translating it to driving a race car, like, you know exactly what he means by that, which is just a great turn of phrase by Bruce McLaren. At a test at Riverside, they were very high on the car, but it turns out what it was that the Shelby just really liked to run in clean air. In the dirty air of pack racing, the car was a handful, which is very unpredictable. They would eventually lap as fast as 162 miles an hour on Tuesday, but they just really couldn't find the speed. Furthermore, rumor was that USAC found out about the variable analyst and was planning a surprise inspection at the track that night. So Shelby called a meeting with the team, their sponsors, Ken Wallace, and the drivers. They decided the cars might not qualify for the race, let alone win it, and so to spare the embarrassment of failing a surprise inspection to the sponsors, they would withdraw from the race. They packed up the cars in the middle of the night and departed the track. Then, though, there's the Lotus Garage. So, moving on from 67's turbo car, Grand Italian STP had teamed up with Colin Chapman and Lotus to build their 68 Challenger, the Lotus 56. Slightly more conventional design than the turbo car, the 56 placed the turbine engine immediately behind the driver rather than having the driver sit next to it. It did, however, utilize the Ferguson four-wheel drive system again at Grand Italian's insistence. It does sort of fly a little bit in the face of the old Colin Chapman saying of simplify and then add lightness. Like, you get an all-wheel drive turbo car that's not simple and it's not light. But Andy Granatelli was, I guess, a hard guy to argue with. So the 56 is a beautiful day glow colored wedge design with fat firestones on all four corners and a JT6 turbine engine. And actually, guys, that JT6 engine was also part of the reason that Shelby wasn't going to appear in the race. So the story goes that Granatelli was going to use the same GE engines as Shelby for his cars, and Andy knew that Shelby had found some way around the 16-inch analyst limitation, so he made a deal with Craig Breedlove. For 68, Granatelli would help Breedlove with his own turbine car, built to Breedlove specifications, sponsored by STP, if Breedlove told Granatelli about Shelby's planned way around the restriction. Breedlove told him what he knew, but their deal ended up falling apart because Breedlove, I guess, didn't want to take spy pictures of the modifications to Shelby's T58s. So a little bit of intrigue, I guess, back the 68 Indy 500. So when the Lotus 56s showed up with Pratt & Whitney JT6s rather than GE T58s like Shelby, it set off a thought in Breedlove's head. Granatelli's cars were 100% legal, and he knew the way in which Shelby's weren't. Breedlove thought Granatelli was likely to dime Shelby out to USAC, and fearing embarrassment for Goodyear, Breedlove allegedly called Goodyear's Racing Division President Larry Truesdale to tell him what was going on. Fearing an outright ban by USAC, Goodyear may have voiced their opinion to Shelby in that all-hands-on-deck meeting when they pulled out of the race that night. Anyway, Granatelli would show up to Indy with four 56s and a very impressive driver lineup, but there were issues there. Jim Clark was to be the lead driver, but he was killed shortly before in an F2 race, though he did briefly test the 56. His replacement was Mike Spence, who would be killed during practice at Indy. That actually led when Shelby pulled out, he made a statement. He said, quote, "After complete and intensive testing, I feel at the present time it's impossible to make a turbine powered competitive with a reasonable degree of safety. Therefore, I'm withdrawing the Shelby Racing Co. turbines from the 1968 race." That rubbed Andy Granatelli and everybody the right way, because realistically, Spence's crash didn't have anything to do with the turbine or the design of the car, and it sort of sounded to them like it was Shelby, you know, taking a shot now that he had nothing, no real dog in the fight, I suppose. Anyway, though, that left three cars for Graham Hill, Joe Leonard, and Art Pollard. Faced with the same analyst restrictions as Shelby, Granatelli and Lotus had just done a better job of optimizing their car instead of getting a bit cheaty. Joe Leonard would put his car on pole, and Hill followed him in second, with both of them turning laps faster than 171 miles an hour, which is the first time that they, I believe, they had ever had more than one car over 170 miles an hour at Indy. Interestingly, even though the 56 was on pole, where the turbo car qualified sixth, the 56 didn't outpace its rivals in the same way. It was actually a very competitive race. Leonard and Hill ran up front early, but about halfway through, Hill would lose a wheel and crash. Leonard led with eight laps to go, but snapped a fuel shaft right about the same time that Art Pollard behind him did the same. Once again, Andy Granatelli's turbine cars would fail a stone's throw away from the finish line. Ultimately, the story of the turbine engines at Indy does end there. USAC would effectively ban them from 1974, saying any turbines must be of, quote, automotive type. Given the only automotive type turbine was one Ford was using for trucks, the breed was effectively dead. The Lotus 56 would return to Indy in 1969, but in a modified form, Art Pollard would convert one to Offenhauser power. The car would only make it about 7 laps before it failed. Silver lining, though, that 69 race would finally be the one where Andy Granatelli and STP got their Indy 500 win. And in fact, it would also be the one where Mario Andretti would get his win. He would drive the STP Lotus 64, a four-wheel drive racer powered by Ford's now turbocharged Indy V8. But he would crash during practice due to a design flaw, resulting in the other two 64s being pulled from the race as well. I think it was something about hubs heating up, but yeah. Andretti would actually get into his backup car, a Bronner Hawk Ford, lead 116 laps, and win the race when Lloyd Ruby retired his Mongoose. However, the Turbine and the Lotus 56 were not done quite yet. In Indy, yeah, sure, they were cooked, but the car got a look in Formula One as well. Modified a bit with a different Pratt & Whitney turbine engine, but retaining the four-wheel drive single-speed setup, Lotus ran the 56B in a few races in 71 when their main F1 car was the Lotus 72, which was a massively successful racer. So it's interesting that, you know, even with that level of success in Formula One, they're still looking for something that maybe could just be just a tiny bit better. The car had the start of a great showing at Zandvoort, with Dave Walker picking up 10 spots in 5 laps, lapping faster than the leaders on a wet track. Clearly the best car out there, but Walker would go off and DNF. I do kind of wonder, because it was a wet weather race, it seems like that maybe the input lag from the turbine was a good thing, you know, because you're not just going to spin it up all of a sudden, and you know, it was maybe almost worked like a little bit like traction control. I think that's kind of neat. The best result for the car would be in 8th place at Monza for Emerson Fittipaldi, who called it the worst race car he had ever driven. And now that, finally, is the end of turbine engines in open-wheel racing, and realistically, the end of anything very cool or different for that matter. There was something like the Eagle Aircraft Flyer Special in 1982, but that was less cool and different and more junk. So that'll do it for this episode of the Race Car Podcast. Next episode is either the Panos GTR1 or Bigfoot, the monster truck. I haven't decided yet, so, you know, we'll see. Anyway, guys, thanks for listening. Appreciate you. Have a good one.